Here the baker gave a start, and the gaze of his staring eyes moved still further aside, until he was looking out of the left outside and the right inside corners. He kept beginning a sentence, only to take it back and begin again. Yet all the while he only talked himself deeper in, for his words were addressed downwards, and he could not turn them round. "Pardon me, I did not mean to say that," he began again. "At least I did not intend to say it just like that. I do hope that you are not getting a wrong idea. You are a worldly wise young man, and we would enlist your understanding in support of our innocence. I talk, but when I listen to my own words, I am alarmed. I might be making you feel that I am invoking a sacredness so mighty that it is so great and so deep that it is almost suspect itself, so to speak, and invoking it might even work the other way from what I want. I beg you, summon all your understanding. Do not be confused into the idea that if the evidence is too strong, that makes it weaker, or even makes it help to prove the opposite. That would be frightful. It would endanger the soundness of your judgment for you to come on such thoughts. Look at me. Even though I do not look at you, but at my arguments. I guilty? I involved in such an affair? Am I not the very chief and lord of the bread? Servant of the wandering mother who seeks her daughter with the torch? The fruit-bringer, the all-giver, giving warmness and greenness, who rejected the benumbing blood of the grape and gave the malt drink preference, who brought to mankind wheat and barley, and first broke the clod with the curving plough, so that from milder nourishment milder customs sprang, whereas aforetime men ate roots and grasses, and even one another. To her I belong, consecrate to her, who in the wind on the threshing floor winnows corn and chaff and separates honor from dishonor, the lawgiver who gives justice and regulates free will. Judge now in your wisdom if I could have engaged in such a sinister affair. Judge on the basis of unfitness, which does not so much rest on the fact that the affair is sinister. Justice, like bread, being allied to the dark realm and to the womb of the earth below, where dwell the avenging goddesses, so that one might call it, in its sacredness, the watchdog of the goddess. The more so since the dog is in fact sacred to her, and from that point of view, you might also call me, who am sacred to her, a dog. Here he broke off with another frightful start, and his eyelids darted right over into the opposite corners. He asseverated that he had not meant to say what he had said, or at least not the way he had said it. But Joseph soothed them both, begging them not to take things so hard, and not strain themselves on his account. He knew how to prize it, he said, and was honored to have them tell him about their affair. Or if not about the affair, at least the reasons why it could not have been their affair. But still less was it his affair to set himself as judge over them, for he was commanded only to be their servant, who inquired after their wishes, as they had been accustomed. Of course, they were also accustomed to having their wishes carried out, and that, much to his regret, he was largely unable to do. But at least they had the first half of what they were used to, and he asked if they would honor him with another command. No, they said pensively, they knew of nothing. No other commands would be likely to occur to one, seeing that nothing came of them. Ah, but why must he leave them so soon? Would he not tell them how long he thought the investigation of the charges against them would take, and how long they would have to lie in this hole? He would tell them faithfully and at once, he replied, if he only knew. But naturally he did not. He could only make an entirely arbitrary and irresponsible guess. It would take 30 and 10 days in all, at the most and the least, until their fate was decided. "Ah, how long!" lamented the butler. "Ah, how short!" cried the baker, but at once gave another frightful start, and assured them that he also had meant to say, "How long?" But the chief butler reflected, and then remarked that Joseph's calculation had probably got some sense to it, for in 30 and 7 and 3 days, counting from their arrival, it would be Pharaoh's beautiful birthday, well known as a day of justice and compassion. On that day, in all probability, their fate would be decided. "I did not, to my knowledge, think of it," answered Joseph, "and did not make my calculations according. It was more of an inspiration. But seeing it turns out that Pharaoh's exalted birthday falls just on that day, you can see that my words are already beginning to be fulfilled." Of the Stinging Worm. With that he went, shaking his head over his two charges and their affair, about which he now knew more than he could well admit. Nobody in the two lands might appear or assume to know more than was considered seemly for men to know, and this perilous knowledge was hushed up by the authorities in a cloud of circumlocution and secrecy, a screen of words about flies and pieces of chalk, and unidentifiable made-up names like Hatred of God and Scum of Weset. Nevertheless, it was soon talked of through the length and breadth of the whole kingdom. Everybody, whether he used the prescribed circumlocutions or not, knew what was behind these minimizings and palliations. The story, in all its shockingness, did not lack popular appeal. One might even say that it had a ritual character, seeming as it did, like the repetition in the present, of events whose foundation lay far back in the past. To put it bluntly, somebody had been conspiring against Pharaoh's life. This, although the days of the majesty of that elderly god were well known to be numbered anyhow, and it is common knowledge that their inclination to unite again with the sun could not be arrested, either by the advice of the magicians and physicians of the bookhouse, or even by the mediation of Ishtar of the Way, which His Majesty's brother and father-in-law of the Euphrates, Tushratta, king over Kanigalbat, or Mitanni land, had solicitously sent to him. But that the great house, Si Re, son of the sun and lord of the two crowns, Neb Ma Re Amenhotpe, was old and ailing and could scarcely breathe, was no reason at all why he should not be conspired against. Indeed, if you liked, it was a very good reason why he should. However dreadful, of course, such an enterprise remained. It was a universally known fact that Re himself, the sun god, had originally been king of the two lands, or rather ruler on earth over all men, and had ruled them with majestic brilliance and blessing so long as his years were still young, mature, or middle-aged, and even for some considerable period of time into his beginning and increasing age. But when he got very old, and painful infirmities and frailties, though of course splendid in their form, approached the majesty of this god, he had found it good to withdraw from the earth and retire into the upper regions, for his bones gradually turned to silver, his flesh to gold, and his hair to genuine lapis lazuli, a very beautiful form of senescence, yet attended with all sorts of ailments and pains, for which the gods themselves had sought 1,000 remedies, but all in vain. Since no herb that grows can avail against the diseases of gilding and silvering and lapidification, those troubles of advanced old age. Yet even under these circumstances, the old Re had always clung to his earthly sovereignty, although he must have seen that owing to his own weakness it had begun to relax, that he had ceased to be feared and even to be respected. Now Isis, the great one of the island, Eset, a millionfold fertile in guile, felt that her moment was come. Her wisdom embraced heaven and earth, like that of the superannuated old Re himself. But there was one thing she did not know or command, and the lack of it hampered her. She did not know the last, most secret name of Re, his very final one, knowledge of which would give power over him. Re had very many names, each one more secret than the one before, yet not utterly hopeless to find out, save one, the very last and mightiest. That he still withheld. Whoso could make him name it, he could compel him and outdistance him and put him under his feet. Therefore Eset conceived and devised a serpent, which should sting Re in his golden flesh. Then the intolerable pain of the sting, which only great Eset could cure who made the worm, would force Re to tell her his name. Now, as she contrived it, So was it fulfilled. The old Ray was stung, and in torments was forced to come out with one of his secret names after another, always hoping that the goddess would be satisfied before they got to the last one. But she kept on to the uttermost, until he had named her the very most secret of all, and the power of her knowledge over him was absolute. After that, it cost her nothing to heal his wound. But he only got a little better, within the wretched limits in which so old a creature can, and soon thereafter he gave up and joined the great majority. Thus, tradition, known by heart to every child of Kame. It did suggest that Pharaoh had had something done to him, since he gradually got worse until his condition was so like that of the old god that one tended to mix them up. But there had been one particular individual who had taken the ancient tradition quite peculiarly to heart, a certain inmate of Pharaoh's House of Women, the private and well-guarded pavilion of the greatest elegance adjoining the Palace Merrimat, whither Pharaoh still had himself carried now and then, of course only to chuck one or other of their graces under the chin, perhaps to defeat her on the board of 30 fields, and at the same time to enjoy the lute-playing, dancing, and singing of the rest of the sweet-scented troupe. Often, indeed, he played a game with that very female who took so seriously the old legend of Isis and Ray that she yielded to the temptation to reenact it. Nobody, however well versed in the finer points of this story, can tell this woman's name. It has been obliterated from tradition. The night of everlasting forgetfulness shrouds it. And yet the woman had been in her time a favorite concubine of Pharaoh, and 12 or 13 years before, when he still condescended to beget a child, she had borne him a son, Nofer-Kap-Ptah, this name is preserved, who, as a scion of the godlike seed, received a special education, and on whose account she, a concubine, was privileged to wear the vulture headdress. It was not quite so elaborate a one as that worn by Ti, the great royal consort herself, but nonetheless a gold vulture cap. This cap, and her maternal weakness for Nofer-Kap-Ptah, went to the woman's head, and were fatal to her. For the headdress incited her to confuse herself with the wily Eset, and to cherish ambitions hallowed by tradition, and mixed up with her doting fondness for her little half-breed. The ancient records dazed her small and scheming brain, so that she made up her mind to have Pharaoh stung by a serpent, to instigate a palace revolt, and set on the throne of the two lands not Horus Amenhotep, the rightful heir, who was sickly anyhow, but the fruit of her own womb, Nofer-Kap-Ptah. The first steps toward the goal of overturning the dynasty, bringing in a new time and elevating the nameless near-favorite to the rank of goddess-mother, had been successfully taken. The plot was hatched in Pharaoh's House of Women,